Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio. This is your host, Dr. John Panero. And as many of you know who listen to the program quite often, I like bringing historians on the program because I'm a historian myself. But my specialty is quite far afield from what we'll be covering today. What I want to look at today is a topic that I remember learning about in grade school and in graduate school. I was fortunate enough to take an entire class on this topic, but only in the wake of September the 11th did I rethink the way the Crusades had been taught to me, both in college and just in a general culture and how we talk about Crusades and how we think about them and it's the Crusades' relationship to Christianity. And so on the program today, I'm happy to play host to Steve Weidenkopf, who has authored a wonderful new book called The Glory of the Crusades. Steve Weidenkopf teaches church history at the Notre Dame Graduate School at Christendom College in Virginia. He's the creator of the Epic Video Series. Some of you might be familiar with that. And is a popular author and speaker on the Crusades and many other historical subjects. I have to say, I've not looked through the Epic Video Series myself, but in preparing for this program, I was quite impressed, and I plan on going out and checking that out. It looks like a great series. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. I'm very glad to be here, and thanks so much for having me.
Sure, you're very welcome. The program Faith and Reason, we tend to stick to stories and topics that are either directly related to or grow out of the Catholic intellectual tradition, and we're just trying to cover that part of our great tradition for the listening audience at Holy Family Radio. And it's a pleasure, then, to talk about such a debated topic today and such an important topic. The Crusades and the narrative of the Crusades has really been owned by everyone from Protestants to Islamic radicals and jihadists for quite some time. And so I think your book is very welcome, as is there's work being done elsewhere by Rodney Stark and others, non-Catholic scholars on the Crusades, too. Maybe the place we could start today is just I can just ask you, hey, what is a Crusade? What do we mean by that? We hear about a Crusade for Christ on college campuses. We hear the term used derisively sometimes. George Bush was criticized for using this terminology shortly after September the 11th, 2001. What is a crusade?
Yeah, that's a great question, John. And it's interesting because that's one of the questions that actually crusade historians have kind of wrestled with over the number of years, last few decades. There's different camps of historians and how they break out what exactly is a crusade and how do we define crusades and whatnot. So I won't bore you or your audience with that kind of mundane academic discussion among crusade historians. But in general, what a crusade is, or what most historians agree that crusades were, it's really a movement is kind of the better way to think of the crusades. And it was a movement that began in the 11th century in Western Europe when Pope Urban II called the First Crusade at the local meeting of French bishops known as the Council of Clermont in November of 1095. And it's a movement that lasted about 600 years in the church's history, so an exceptionally long period of time. And obviously a movement that lasts that long evolves over time. But initially speaking, and what most people associate the Crusades with are the movements and expeditions, military expeditions against Islam in the East, in the Holy Land, in North Africa and Egypt, in order to recover ancient Christian territory and property that had been taken over by the conquering armies of Muhammad.
Now, was that area of the world at that point, had that become predominantly Muslim yet, or was it still a Muslim minority ruling a very large Christian majority and a large Jewish population as well?
No, by the time of the 11th century, it's a predominantly majority Muslim area. You still have, obviously, pockets of Christians living in the Holy Land and in Anatolia, for example, which was an imperial Byzantine province, which is now modern-day Turkey. There are also, large numbers of different groups of Jews throughout the area as well. But for the most part, by this point, the 11th century, we're talking, it's 500 years or so since, or 400 years since Muhammad, rise to power and that initial conquest by the Islamic armies throughout that region of the world. But by the time you get to the Crusades, majority Muslim population.
Now, you don't deal with this directly in your book, but I am curious about why do you think it became a Muslim majority? And I guess I'm thinking that Christians had been oppressed minorities before, particularly in the very early years of the church under the Roman state. And it seems like they rather easily capitulated in most cases across the face of North Africa in this very Christian region of the world, and in the Holy Land and on into what today is Iraq, that they went in a few generations from being very strongly Christian to just having pockets of Christianity.
Yeah, well, actually, there's some research that's been done that shows that actually that the movement from, minority Muslim rule to a majority Muslim population actually took several centuries. It took about 200, 250 years from the time of the initial Muslim conquest until you actually had, the majority of that area following Islam and following Muhammad. So we definitely know that for centuries, Christians living in those areas actually held their faith for a long period of time. But there's, if to answer your question as to why, eventually they did become a Muslim-dominated area, majority population, is because of just the way Islam sees the world, right? And then the community that, and the dichotomy, rather, that Islam presents the world to itself. Islam sees the world in two different camps. It sees it in the Dar al-Islam, or the House of Islam, and the Dar al-Harb, or the House of War. So you have this understanding that there are, all non-Muslims, even Christians and Jews, are in this, although they're a special status because they're people of the book, as they refer to them, but they're still in this community called the House of War, and it's the job of every Muslim believer and of Islam in general to bring those members in the House of War into the House of Islam. And so, and society, Islamic society, for those living in those societies that are non-Muslim, it's very, very restrictive. There were certain, there's certain jobs that you can't hold. You couldn't testify in court, for example, because your testimony was considered to be immediately suspect and not trustworthy because you weren't a Muslim. You couldn't have weapons. You couldn't build new churches. You couldn't even necessarily repair old churches. So over time, this very oppressive societal structure that Islam has, based on this division of its identity and of the community and the world as a whole, that wears down, right? I mean, you can't succeed in society, you can't advance in society, materially speaking, socially speaking, unless you are a Muslim. And so, people can hold out for a long period of time, but eventually, that tends to, the societal factors and cultural factors, I think, tend to play a significant role.
Right. It's, what you're saying, we could change a few of the terms and we'd be talking about Queen Elizabeth I's England, wouldn't we?
Exactly.
And the
right.
Penal laws, yeah. Et cetera. But I don't want to take us too far afield, but it's there certainly are amazing similarities when you're trying to take down, I guess, the cultural majority and their religion, and a deeply rooted religion at that. Why don't we consider, when we talk about the Crusades, why don't we talk about Iberia and the multi-century struggle against the Arab Muslim rulers and what is now Spain and Portugal that was turned back around the year 800 and late 700s, I guess?
Sure. Yeah. In Iberia, in modern day Spain and Portugal, I mean, there was this, it's called the Reconquista, or this really 770 year war of Catholics trying to recover and liberate their territory from Islam, which was finally accomplished in the late 15th century, actually in 1492, when the last Muslim stronghold in Granada was overthrown. But some historians, actually, I mentioned earlier at the top of the show here, where historians do kind of differ among what the definition of a crusade actually is, and some historians do group the Reconquista in the crusading movement. Others don't, and so I don't address that in my books, mm-hmm. per se, because I'm primarily focused on the eight traditionally numbered crusades against Islam in the Holy Land and in North Africa. But Spain's a different category onto itself, because it was an area where you already had parts of the territory already conquered by Islam. The armed pilgrimage that the popes asked warriors to engage in, which we call crusades, were not most. I mean, there are a few minor ones that were actually allowed to go on in Spain, where warriors could receive the crusade indulgence for participating in the Reconquista. But those are very minor and few and far between. For the most part, the orientation was always towards the east, primarily because the political situation in Spain as a whole, and you already had Christian kingdoms there who were fighting and trying to make inroads into liberating their territory. So it's a debate among historians now as to whether to include it. Again, some see it as a you know, kind of an ancillary part of the crusade, and others not. I mean, one example is the Second Crusade. You know, there were a group of English sailors who were participating in the Second Crusade who actually stopped and did participate in the liberation of some territory in Iberia on their way to participate in the Second Crusade. So it's kind of, you know, it's even a fluid understanding in some cases as well.
Well, then why don't we move on then to the east and take a look at the Holy Land. And the Holy Land had always, of course, claimed a great deal of the Christian's imagination. And so, I think of myself, let's say I'm in Europe and it's the 900s or we're getting into the 11th century, let's say. And I've never been able to go to the Holy Land. It's been under Muslim control. I've heard many stories over the years about how it was hard under the Arabs for Christians from Europe to go on pilgrimages to the Holy Land, but easier under the Turks and vice versa. Do you have any sense of how difficult it would have been for a European who could afford it, so let's say a European noble, to go on a pilgrimage to Christian sites in the Holy Land when it was under Muslim control?
Yeah, sure. So, there were periods of time where it was fairly simple in terms of if one could afford it, as you mentioned, to go, and you would not receive any kind of harassment. But there were other times when, and this is as you get towards the end of the 11th century, where it became quite a lot more difficult, actually, to go on pilgrimage to Jerusalem in particular. And that really changes, and where that change happens is when you have in the 11th century the rise of the Seljuk Turks. So the Seljuks come down from the Asian steppe, and they're Muslim. They converted to Islam, but they're not Arabs, obviously. So they come down, and they conquer that area of the Holy Land, and they harass pilgrims substantially. We have one kind of famous example is the Bishop of Bamberg, a man by the name of Gunther, who in the 1160s led a pilgrimage to Jerusalem with a good number of people from his diocese, and some accounts place it as high as 12,000 people, were in the Holy Land on pilgrimage on their way to Jerusalem, and they were slaughtered to a man almost by the Seljuk Turks on Good Friday, several days march outside of Jerusalem. So at that point, when Urban calls and his call for the First Crusade is in response to the Byzantine emperor asking him to send him warriors to help with this situation with the Seljuks and other groups of Turks in Anatolia, that's when it became, it was really volatile. And there were periods of time where it was volatile, periods of time when there was peace. So it wasn't a constant kind of, we can never go to the Holy Land because it's so dangerous, at least from possible attacks from Islam. It varied, but as you get towards the end of the 11th century, it really is a significant issue. And that's one of the major issues as to why the First Crusade was called. It's one of the things that Urban mentions in the accounts we have of his speech at Clermont as to what he emphasized. And one of them was, the groans of the Christians, native Christians who live in the area who are being persecuted, but also pilgrims who are trying to leave and who are being harassed or being killed, and people who can't even go now because it's so unsafe.
So then we have a few motives so far then, right? So we're the crusaders from the West, the Franks primarily, the French primarily, I think, in the First Crusade are going to go east at the behest of the Pope, but also at the behest of the Byzantine Emperor, the ruler of the Greek half, the leftover remains of the Roman Empire, to help defend Byzantine lands, which are also Christian lands, but also to help defend even Westerners who were there on pilgrimage. So they're defending pilgrims. How do they take on the character of pilgrims themselves? That is, how do they take on some kind of sacred character at this time where what they're doing isn't what they're doing going to be seen as a holy act or earn them indulgences and that sort of thing?
Sure. So what Urban does at the Council of Clermont during the First Crusade is he has, and this develops over time again in the movement, but what he asks for people to do, what he asks for warriors in particular to do, is to vow to go on an armed pilgrimage specifically to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre of Jerusalem. So he sets the goal of the First Crusade is to go and to liberate the Holy City of Jerusalem, and in particular the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So what a warrior would do in responding to Urban's call, and then in subsequent crusades responding to other popes' calls, warriors would publicly, before the church's representative, a bishop or even a priest, would say, I pledge to go to wherever the crusade was going, in this case to Jerusalem, And then that was a formal ecclesiastical act. It was a binding vow that this warrior took in order to accomplish that pilgrimage. And as a sign that they had entered into this vow, they actually took a cloth cross and they sewed it onto their garments. So they never used the word crusade. That's actually a much more modern word that developed from the 18th century on, and we use today to describe these events. But contemporaries never, ever use those words. So if you were to travel back in time to 1096 and see somebody on the road with a garment that had a cross on it and say, "Hey, are you going on crusade?" they would look at you like you're crazy. I have no idea what you're talking about. They referred to what they were doing as the passagia, or the passage, the pilgrimage, the journey. And those who went were called cruces signati, or those from the Latin, those signed with the cross. So that's how they marked themselves out as specifically these, holy warriors in God's army marching on the way to liberate Jerusalem.
Was there any precedent for armed pilgrims? I guess, the odd pilgrim in self-defense, perhaps, but I mean armed pilgrims like those that eventually evolved into the military religious orders. Was there precedent prior to Urban II's call for the crusade?
No, actually, there wasn't. That's a very good question. And actually, just to correct a bit, you said that even pilgrims would, have a weapon for self-defense. Actually, previous to this time, or before Urban's time and his cause, it was a revolutionary call on the part of Urban to do this. But every pilgrim who went on a pilgrimage, an official pilgrimage, could not carry weapons.
Wow. I would have been a bad pilgrim then.
Yeah.
Thank you for correcting me, though.
No, I mean, because that was seen as part of the danger from robbers or bandits or just even the long journey. That was part of the penitential process of going, and part of the penance of going on a pilgrimage. But many warriors, actually, many noblemen in particular, who, raised from 5-6 years old to in the martial arts to be warriors, to be defenders, to participate in combat, for them to put down their arms, and this is their vocation in a certain sense, to put down their arms and go on a pilgrimage, was difficult for many to do. Obviously, nobles did go on pilgrimage, but for many, it was a hard decision to make, and many did not make it. So when Urban came along, and said, "Hey, I want you to use your vocation. I want you to use what you've been training to do for your entire life at the service of Christ and the service of church, and I will grant you a spiritual benefit, the indulgence, by doing this." Warriors jumped at the chance. I mean, it's estimated that 60,000 warriors responded to Urban's call on the First Crusade. I mean, it's an outstanding number, especially for the time.
And so that popular misconception, one that you deal with in your book, The Glory of the Crusades, is that the Crusaders were motivated primarily, and we all have mixed motivations, as did the Spanish explorers and such, but primarily motivated by greed or the possibility of plunder. Why don't you spend a few minutes more disproving that for us? That's one of the main that's the main focus in your book, disproving that popular misconception that it was greed that drove particularly the nobles as some kind of a neo-colonial powers into what we now call the Middle East.
Exactly. Yeah, I remember learning that actually as I was going through, grade school and high school and even in undergrad, that, the reason why the Crusades happened was, it's kind of a twofold myth. I mean, the first is that there was this, the first part of it is that there was this large increase in population in Western Europe, in the 11th century. And that part actually is true. There was a significant increase in population. But, as a result of that, the myth goes that you had all these second, third, and fourth born sons, who could not inherit land and title and property from their family due to European nobility, focus on primogeniture or only the firstborn son inheriting land and whatnot. And so you had these second, third, and fourthborn sons who were all fighting with each other in Western Europe in order to acquire land and property. And that, again, is partially true. And so what the church decided to do is to bring about peace, they marshaled all these second, third, fourthborn sons together and decided to send them overseas. 2,000 miles away from home to conquer land from the peaceful and tolerant and diverse Muslims, and that's how you would solve the problem, right? That's how the myth goes. And when you begin to kind of pull back, the onion and pull the string on that myth, it's there's all kinds of things you see or that are clearly illustrated to show how that was incorrect. And Jonathan Riley Smith actually is one of the main crusade historians of the last 40 years who's single-handedly kind of destroyed this myth himself through his research. But what he's shown is that it wasn't the second, third, and fourth-born sons who went on crusade primarily, but it was the first-born sons. The ones who stood the most to lose were the ones who actually went. And he describes, sees and looks at the reason for why that was. It's because French families had such a great devotion to the holy city of Jerusalem So much so that in the 1060s, for example, a very popular name for a French girl was Jerusalem. They named their daughters after the holy city. So they had such great devotion to the city that, and when the Pope asked them to put their arms to the service of the church to liberate the city, they jumped at the chance. And they wanted, the family considered it such a high honor to participate that, that the one who should represent the family on this, this pilgrimage, this expedition, is, should be the firstborn son. You know, again, the one who is, who would inherit everything, the one who had the most to lose. So he wasn't, you know, the these families weren't motivated primarily by that, you know, this land grab, so to speak, from that perspective. Also, too, another way to kind of defeat this myth and see it is that the cost was just extremely expensive to go on crusade. It's estimated it took a knight 4 to 5 times his annual income to go on crusade, which is a substantial sum. We have all kinds of records, charters they're known as, of noble European families, especially the French, selling their land, selling family property, selling their wealth, disposing of their wealth in order to their future wealth, in order to get current, you know, money and wealth in order to finance the expedition. Most crusaders who survived and came back home came back much more impoverished than when they left. You're talking at least a 2 to 3 year journey. There's a very high probability that you're going to die. The casualty rate of the first crusade was 80%. 80% of those who participated never came home. And so people knew that. In the subsequent crusades, you knew there was a high potential that you would die. And so no one, you know, lightly entered into this this decision to go. It was always a voluntary type decision. No one was ever forced or mandated to go. And so you had to sit down and calculate the risks involved and the benefits. And the spiritual benefits far outweighed the material benefits.
Was the success of the first crusade what then drew in kings and a few unruly types, those who may have been just bent on plunder? I'm thinking of maybe the Venetian merchants who I think, unless you're going to correct me on this, diverted the Fourth Crusade.
Sure. Yeah. No. In terms of the Fourth Crusade, that's a whole very long and interesting and complicated story. But even for the Venetians, it wasn't so much. The diversion of that wasn't necessarily from them specifically. I mean, the diversion to the first, on the Fourth Crusade to Constantinople, which ultimately led in the sack of the city and a great despoiling of the city, that obviously wasn't the intended objective. The diversion happened for a whole series of just bad decisions that were made primarily by the Crusaders. They overestimated the number of Crusaders they thought were going to show up in Venice. Venice had suspended their merchant activity for an entire year to build the ships that they thought they would need in order to transport the army that the Crusaders told them that they would need, or that they expected. And so they were, in serious amounts of financial stress and possible ruin if they didn't, receive enough money to recover what they had lost in preparing for the crusade. And really what diverted and who diverted the Fourth Crusade to Constantinople was an Easterner. It was Alexius Angelus, who was a Byzantine prince whose father had been deposed by his uncle to the throne of the emperor. And he wanted to restore his father and then therefore obviously ensure his claim to the throne. And so he came to the Venetians and to the Crusaders when they were encamped in a city in Hungary, modern-day Hungary, called Zara. And asked for the land controlled by the king of Hungary. And so he asked them to help him restore him to the throne of Constantinople. And so that's why they actually went to the city. And then from there, all kinds of other decisions were made that ultimately led to the sack. So, it's not as clean to say that the Fourth Crusade was motivated by greed. You could say the decisions were made in order to recover, financial means, and that was maybe a driving factor of why certain things happened, but not the overarching goal from it. And just another reason or data point to describe why, the Crusades were primarily not about greed, not to say that, again, as you mentioned, each individual Crusader had a multitude, a mix of motivations, as to why they took the cross. And it's not to say that some didn't think that they might possibly gain some material benefit from doing this. But again, that wasn't the primary motivating factor. And it's evidenced by the fact that the vast majority of those who went on crusade, after they finished the crusade, if it was successful, which most of them weren't, but especially the First Crusade, most of those who survived actually left and went home. They didn't stay, you know, to establish any kind of, you know, large land holdings or things like that. There were some that did, and they created what we come to be known as the Crusader States in the Holy Land. But most didn't stay because they were pilgrims, and that's what you do on a pilgrimage. Just like you and I today would go to Jerusalem or Rome or wherever pilgrimage, we go, we visit the shrines, we pray, and we leave. That's what these men did as well.
This is Dr. John Pinero. You're listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio. I'm talking today with Steve Weidenkopf, author of The Glory of the Crusades. And for the last 20 minutes or so, we've been talking about a few myths about the Crusades that our guests would like to clear up, and also just about what the Crusades were and what they were not. Now, there's a number of events or incidents that stand out in my mind that I've heard over the years. And, you know, I'm a professional historian, and prior to reading your book, I wasn't too sure on the truth of these matters either. And one of them is the massacre of Jerusalem, the so-called massacre of Jerusalem, that if there's one blot on the First Crusade, and there may be others in terms of what some would say, but if there's one blot on the maybe the most spiritual of these crusades, it would be this massacre, where we hear these phrases of the people running knee deep in the blood of the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and killing civilians, not simply Muslims, but really anybody who's there, which is going to be Christian, Jewish, Muslim, and what have you. How do you approach that? What's your take on that so-called massacre?
Sure. Yeah, that's a very, very prevalent in modern day myth, and it comes up very, you know, frequently. And just kind of the most famous example of that was I think it was in November of 2001, soon after the September 11th, 2001 attacks, when former President Bill Clinton gave a speech at Georgetown University. Kind of as a part of that speech, he was trying to answer the question, why were we attacked? And he specifically mentioned that event of the massacre, so-called massacre in Jerusalem after the First Crusade, and how you know Muslims in that area of the world are still upset by that event. And that was at least a possible motivation, or one of the motivations for Osama bin Laden's attack. And unfortunately, former President Bill Clinton didn't really understand the history, and so I think made a major mistake in citing that in his speech. And when you look at it, the details of that, first of all, I guess it's probably important to point out where this myth kind of originates, and it kind of comes, unfortunately, from some. Initially from a misreading of Crusader sources. So there was an anonymous source called the Gesta Francorum that mentions the massacre. There was even a letter that was sent back to the Pope from many of the First Crusade leaders describing their activities in the city after they liberated it. And then even Fulcher of Sharta, who was a member of the First Crusade but was not present at the massacre of Jerusalem. He came to the city later. He was up in Edessa at the time. But when he gets to Jerusalem, he writes of what, you know, the so-called event of what happened there. And they use that language that you mentioned. They use language in these sources, things like, you know, we killed so many people that blood was running up to our knees, was running up to the bridle of our horses, you know, that kind of thing, and that imagery. And so when a modern person looks at that, at language, you know, we tend to read things literally. We tend to believe that accounts of events are, you know, actual, kind of minute by minute accounts. We're used to we're the CNN world where, you know, we have reporters embedded in combat units that tell us, you know, every second of what's going on and that kind of thing, from a very factual, empiristic kind of perspective. But you have to read these sources as the way medievalists or, you know, medieval people, contemporaries would have read them. And someone hearing, the Gesta Francorum, for example, or someone reading it who could, in reading of this account that the Crusaders had slaughtered so many people that blood was running up to the knees or to the bridle of the horses, they would have immediately understood that was not an actual portrayal or a scientific kind of portrayal of the events. They would have immediately understood that that language was more of a biblical and scriptural type of analogy. It's which you can find actually in the Book of Revelation. There's an analogy, or in the Book of Revelation, it talks about the four horsemen of the apocalypse and they're coming down and passing God's judgment on the world, and that how blood was running up to the bridle of the horses and that kind of thing. So they would have known immediately that scriptural reference, and would have known how that passage is interpreted. And what that means is it symbolizes and signifies God's judgment on these people. And so how a person living during the time of the First Crusade would have understood that story is that it was God's, that the victory in Jerusalem was a victory of God's army over the enemies of God. It was a judgment from by God against the Islamic forces holding the city of Jerusalem. That's how they would have understood it. Now, there was, you know, the Crusaders did get into the city of Jerusalem. There was much death and destruction in the city, as you can imagine. It's war, so, you know, people die. But you have to, again, take it into context in terms of a military context. At the time, military tactics on both the Christian and the Muslim side, they were all, you know, widely established customs and tactics. That if an army came to a city, a walled city that was going to defend itself, the army asked for the city to surrender. If the city refused to surrender and the invading army or the besieging army got into the city, then it was no holds barred. It was pretty much the invading army could do whatever they wanted to. And again, that happened both on Christian and Islamic sides. So we have to keep that in mind, the context of the event. So it's not uncommon that something like that would happen. Were there non-combatants that were killed? Yes, there were, you know, many combatants that were killed as well. One estimate that I've seen is probably the best estimate of how many were killed was about 3,000 people were killed out of a city of about 30,000. So that kind of gives you a perspective. It's a good number of loss of life, but it's not this, you know, wholesale slaughter where they killed every single man, woman, and child in the city.
So I guess what I'm thinking at this point, we've talked about the First Crusade then and the so-called massacre. And, you know, people did get massacred, as you say, they get killed in wartime. Was there any penance required of the knights, even though they're on pilgrimage, even though they've been blessed, even though they've taken up the cross, at least in the First Crusade, do they still have to do penance for killing? Was that the case for knights no matter what, or was that somehow different in a crusade as well?
Yeah, the crusade was a penitential exercise, you know, all through the expedition, actually. So, I mean, during the crusades, there'd be periods of time of fasting. You know, there'd be periods of time of other kinds of spiritual, of mass, and obviously of prayers and other kinds of penitential work. So they prepared themselves, obviously, penitentially to participate in the crusade itself. But in terms of, you know, did they have to perform a specific penance because there was, you know, death during the crusade itself? I mean, generally speaking, no. I mean, for individual acts of barbarity or other things that were not in keeping, obviously, with the just war criteria or of other, you know, bad acts or horrible acts, and for each individual knight that you know possibly could have been the case with you know priests and bishops who attended the crusades with them, you know, they could have come and asked, obviously, for participated in the sacrament of confession and asked for forgiveness for those specific acts. But generally speaking, the church made a distinction between, and the church does even today, still makes a distinction between, you know, the killing of innocent life and the killing of another individual during war, right? In terms of, you know, we all have an ability to defend ourselves against attack. We also have, the warriors and soldiers have an ability to participate in combat for a just reason, and deaths that are caused as a result of their actions in that combat are not to be imputed to them, again, as long as they, you know, act in a moral way. So, you know, there's a difference between innocent life and then malice, you know, killing those who are evil or participating in evil or who are the enemy.
Now, when Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda used the Crusades as propaganda to say, hey, look, we're attacking the Crusader countries, and when the United States and its allies invaded Afghanistan to go after al-Qaeda in 2001, Osama bin Laden said, look, here they come. All the crusading countries have hopped on board. They're recolonizing us. He was really taking a play out of the Marxist handbook, among others, in seeing these as colonial attacks, kind of a pre-colonial try it out, kind of like England trying out colonialism on Ireland, I guess, a little bit, you know, the pre-show before the big show. But from the Muslim perspective, historically, Turkish and Arabic, these were kind of just a mere blip on the radar. I mean, these crusading kingdoms kind of came and went, and in a way, weren't they remarkably unsuccessful? I mean, they were hardly in Muslim memory until they were reconstituted maybe less than 100 years ago.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, we've been talking about the First Crusade as an example, and you know, they liberated the Holy City of Jerusalem in 1099, But then in 1187, you know, less than 100 years later, you have the Holy City is conquered again by Islam, by the Muslim general Saladin. So, you know, then and then it's pretty much out of Christian hands, although for a brief period of time over the next century or so with treaties, but it's never really fully, once again, completely in Christian hands, and you know, is not for the rest of history until the present. So, you know, that's so they weren't overwhelmingly successful from a Muslim perspective, as you point out, and so they were for the most part forgotten. You know, the last Christian stronghold on the coast at Acre fell in 1291. So, you know, again, 200 years, less than 200 years from the success of the First Crusade. So these are blips, you're right. And it's not until you get into the late 19th century when you begin to see the downfall and decline, rather, of the Ottoman Empire, where you begin to have histories being written from an Arabic and Turkish and Islamic perspective of trying to explain away the downfall and the, you know, the decline of the Ottoman Empire in terms of, you know, it's not our fault, it's not our policies, it's not our economics that's causing us this issue. It's you know, it's the West, it's the Crusades. You know, this is where it began. They try to come over here and colonize us and take our territory. And then as you get into the 50s and the 60s with Marxist interpretation of history and in the West in particular, you have many Arab students, you know, from various countries in that region going to European universities. They are being taught by these Marxist historians and Marxist professors that, you know, this was a big land grab. It was all about money and economics. It's pre-colonialism. This is what you know, you've been suffering from, your country's been suffering from for the last few decades after the war. And so it feeds itself into Arab nationalism in the 70s, and then it feeds itself from there into, as you mentioned, the camps of Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and others who use it, ISIS, who use it as a form of propaganda to make recruits.
Well, Steve, how did the Crusades then fare in Christian memory? So you had mentioned earlier, and your book talks about this, your book Glory of the Crusades talks about this as well. This is a 600 years or so part of our Christian history. So it's a big chunk, the crusading movement. How did it go away, and how did it come to be seen even by Christians as a very unglorious thing? Not only a thing with no glory, but a thing we ought to be embarrassed of and do penance to this day, and perhaps our popes even ought to be apologizing for.
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, I think it kind of begins, I would think, at least initially, with the fact that, you know, the majority of the Crusades were not successful. So, you know, even during the time of the height of the movement, when, you know, people are still participating en masse and in large numbers, rather, and you have, you know, the Pope asking, continuing to ask people to participate in Crusade. There were critics at the time, but you know, when Crusades weren't successful, the problem with the movement, at least in a certain sense, one perspective, is that the First Crusade was so miraculously and astoundingly successful that people pretty much kind of assumed that, you know, every year, you know, every time we have a Crusade, we're going to be as successful as we were. And when the follow-on Crusades were not, that put a bit of a dim on the movement itself and called into question some aspects of it. But despite that, it still continued to persist for as we've talked about for centuries, primarily because of the active Muslim threat. You know, especially when you get into the 14th and 15th and 16th centuries, and even into the late 17th century with the Ottoman Turks, you know, arriving even at the gates of Vienna, for example, the late 17th century. You know, the crusading movement is still being discussed and still being called for, and indulgence is still being given. So it persists for a while, but how it begins to turn is really the origin of the modern myth, so to speak, is really when you get into the time of the Protestant Reformation, when you have people like Martin Luther, who, you know, rails against anything that the popes are teaching or anything the popes support, anything that might, you know, smack of papal authority. You know, he begins to criticize the Crusades, and from these Protestant, he and the other Protestant thinkers, and so from them it launches itself into the Enlightenment, where you have anti-religious, anti-church advocates who are, you know, creating such myths as we'll just discuss in terms of, you know, they all went for money, this was just a power-hungry papacy trying to control people and get wealth for the church. And then that manifests itself, you know, very easily into our modern world, where people still tend to think that. And that really is kind of related back to this three-volume work of a crusade history that was written by Sir Stephen Runciman in the 1950s. It was a very popular work. Runciman was a Byzantine historian, viewed the Crusades from a Byzantine perspective, and consider them sinful actions, actually. And his history was extremely popular. It's still popular. You can still get it on Amazon today. And it's an easy read. It's a very narrative. It reads almost like a literature, you know, like literature, like a great drama and story. And so it became kind of that, because of that and its popularity, that the narrative and the myths that we have to deal with as Crusader historians today really comes from that. You know, so when Hollywood, for example, makes a film about the Crusades in 2005, Kingdom of Heaven, Ridley Scott's film, you know, he uses Runciman's main narrative as how he should portray the Crusades, because that's what most people have been taught in the English-speaking world in particular, and that's what we think of as the Crusades. And so that still persists today. And that's why you have Catholics, as you mentioned, who want to shy away from this subject, don't want to talk about it, feel ashamed. And that's where my book comes in, and my biggest hope for my book, actually, is to turn that narrative around and to end it, so that Catholics have a better understanding of this movement and are able to defend the church when it needs to be defended, and to be able to talk specifically about these events from an authentic historical perspective.
And I have to say, after reading The Glory of the Crusades, you don't do a whitewash job here. In the beginning of his second biography of St. John Paul II, George Weigel says something like, I'm just paraphrasing, the church doesn't need our lies, and she doesn't need our over-optimistic portrayal of her past or the past of her members. You just you tell the truth, and that's good enough. And I think in your book, this is one of the strengths of The Glory of the Crusades, that you mentioned the massacre, you mentioned pogroms against Jews and the deviations on the Crusades. You even mentioned a story I was not familiar with about involving cannibalism. I mean, I recall hearing stories of these starving Crusaders who had to eat their own horses and rode into battle pretty much on cattle. I mean, just this amazing vision here of the suffering on the Crusades. I recall a lot of these stories, and you cover them, but you do the job of the historian, which is to put some of these things in context, so that we at least appraise them properly. It doesn't mean we make an argument for walking around knee deep in blood simply because we look at what you mean by the glory of the Crusades. And in fact, what that term glory. So you take that from a quotation from Hilaire Belloc, who did a great favor to me and many others by providing a corrective to that Protestant Whig view of history, which portrays the Catholic Church as this mind-shackling beast that we just had to overcome through progress, and thank goodness we did. And Belloc provides a nice corrective on that type of history. And so you take your title from something he wrote about the Crusades. Just for a moment, we'll pause and tell us what you mean by glory, because we have talked about some rather negative parts of the Crusades too, as well. Where is the glory in this?
Yeah. So what I mean by glory is that I take it not only from Belloc, as you mentioned, but also from the Hebrew word that's most often used in the Old Testament for glory, which is kabod, which means something important or something heavy in weight. And so my point to use the title or the word, the glory of the Crusades, is from that perspective, that, again, this is a movement that occupies 600 years of church history. It is such, because of that, it obviously there's something integral to the movement in the church. And that we as Catholics need to, and so it's something very important. So we need to know about that. We need to not just allow modernity and others to present us this, you know, as you mentioned, Belloc's, you know, understanding of the Whig and his fight against the Whig interpretation of history. We need to not allow, you know, that to occur without knowing the full historical facts ourselves. And so that's my kind of clarion call to Catholics. The title of the book is to know about this movement, to know about this period of time of history. Ask yourself the questions, why did the church support this for so long? Maybe there's something more behind just what I'm told, that it's wealth, it's material possessions, it's this or it's that. And so I think in one way that we can, so we've talked about a lot of inglorious things, as we mentioned, but what is something that we as modern day Catholics can kind of take out of what I mean by the glory of the Crusades? And I think primarily what we can take out of that is seeing that these events, are not just kind of historical events in isolation, obviously, that these events were undertaken by real men and women, right? Our brothers and sisters in the Lord who have come before us as members of the church, they left you know, many things behind: family, friends, loved ones. They spent their wealth, to embark on this journey. And in a certain sense, I think we kind of owe it to them to learn why. Why did they do this? And I think by learning and asking those questions and answering them, we can take from them a level of faith that was so rich and so vibrant that we can use them as an example, and hopefully that their faith and their actions, where appropriate and where correct, that we can embody that ourselves. And we live in a culture, obviously, that is not fully alive and vibrant in our Christian faith, and we need to build up that civilization of love and the culture of life, as our popes have been telling us over these last few pontificates. So how do we do that, right? We need to, I think, grow in our Catholic identity. We need to know who we are. We need to know where we came from. And I think we can take examples, again, from the men and women who have come before us in history. And I think the crusaders individually, in many cases, can give us that good example.
Yeah, well put. We can't let other people write our story, and we can't let the culture at large do it. That used to be a largely Protestant culture. Now it's a largely secular culture, but either way, the Catholic Church comes out on the losing end when it comes to the writing of history. So I am thankful to you and to Catholic Answers Press for your book, The Glory of the Crusades. Now, one of the most popular saints has an association with the Crusades, and that's St. Francis of Assisi. And I'm wondering if you might tell us what his role is. My sense it was that Francis was this peace-loving bird watcher of a saint who crossed enemy lines to try to stop people from killing each other. That's probably the common explanation in the culture of this relationship that Francis had to the Crusades.
Sure. Francis was obviously a man of deep holiness, a man who loved Christ and the Church immensely, and he wanted others to have that deep love as well. And he was very focused on the conversion, actually, of Islam, and he hoped for the conversion of Islam, and had oriented many of his friars towards being missionaries and even martyrs to Islamic territory in order to have that be accomplished. Obviously, as history records, he wasn't as successful in that area as he was in other areas of his life. But he did actually, show up at the Crusader camp during the Fifth Crusade when they were encamped outside the city of Damietta in Egypt. He himself didn't take the cross, so he himself was not necessarily officially a Crusader. But he shows up at the camp, he supported the Crusades, and he wanted to bring the Sultan Al-Kamil into the faith. And he hoped by doing so that would, again, spread the faith throughout the Islamic world, and then there would be no need for Crusades because conversion had brought that about. And I should pause here just to mention that conversion itself was not necessarily a main aspect or main ingredient of the Crusades. Actually, for the most part, those Crusades that were directed towards Islam did not have any kind of conversion element to it. That was an ancillary benefit. If it did occur, that was great, but it was never a primary motivator or focus of the Crusades. But so Francis shows up, and he does have that motivation, this desire for conversion, for people to become Catholic and to enter into the Church. And so he actually went. He went to the Crusader camp. He was told by the leader of the Crusade, Cardinal Pelagius, exhorted him to not leave the camp and try to do this. He was afraid that Francis was going to be immediately executed. But miraculously, Francis and a fellow brother, Illuminato, were able to make it to the Muslim sentries. They were taken and not killed immediately, taken to the Sultan, where they spent some time preaching the gospel to Al-Kamil, who, as different accounts record, was in some cases very open to what Francis had to say, but recognized he couldn't convert because, obviously, to convert, to leave Islam and to become an apostate from an Islamic perspective, the punishment for that is death, so that was a concern of him. But he also was concerned for his people as a whole and how they would interpret him leaving the faith and whether that would actually have any benefit for them at all. One tradition records, he actually asked Francis to pray for him when he sent Francis back safely through the Islamic camp back to the Crusader camp. Asked Francis to pray for him and ask him for God to give him the grace and to enlighten his mind so he would know what is the correct path. So Francis did a great, his adventure there in the Crusade was motivated out of the desire of love for God and the Church, which is the same thing, frankly, that motivated the Crusaders.
Are there any other popular saints who bear a close association with the Crusades that you think Catholics ought to know about?
Definitely. Yeah, I don't know if he's necessarily popular. He should be. He's popular in France at the time. But Saint Bernard of Clairvaux was a saint who he preached the Second Crusade, for example. Was very focused on the crusading movement. He helped write and get approval for the Knights Templar, one of the military religious orders, from the Pope. He got him to approve that order, and so he was very focused on the crusading movement and believed that it was something that was very important, not only from a kind of geopolitical, we would call it, sense of the time, but obviously a recovery of Christian territory. But also he focused, Bernard did, primarily on the spiritual aspects, which again is what motivated most people to go, and calling forth and reminding people, medieval people, that participating in a crusade brought about these great spiritual benefits that otherwise were not available unless you went on crusade. And that this was a unique moment in time. It's a unique moment in your life. Bernard would have said to take advantage of this for the salvation of your soul. And he's just a beautiful man. When you read, his writings, he had a deep love for the Blessed Mother, a great theologian as well. And he lived a life of holiness. He attracted others to him so much so that, Cistercians grew abundantly during the course of his lifetime and afterwards, obviously, based on his legacy. So, a great man and a saint that I think many probably more average ordinary Catholics maybe have heard of but don't really know a lot about. And I try to give a sense of his life in my book there to help people get to know him better.
Thank you. Now you mentioned the Knights Templar. Why is it that later popes and bishops, I think, went after the Knights Templar or some of the military religious orders to shut them down with all kinds of wild accusations that I don't know the veracity of the accusations, but I do know they were later severely damaged. Do you know that story? I don't think it's part of your book.
Sure.
But.
No, I don't cover that as much in my book, although I do talk about the Knights Templar just in relationship to the Crusades to the Holy Land, but. So these military religious orders, including the Knights Templar, they're probably the most well-known one because Hollywood uses them all the time in mm-hmm. the Da Vinci Code and movies for conspiracy theories and what have you. So the Knights Templar were this military religious order that grew out of the First Crusades. And, you had, as I mentioned, most First Crusaders left and go back home. Some do stay in the Holy Land to guard and to maintain the territory that they had liberated, which is about 600 miles of a mostly coastal frontier in the Holy Land, and so in parts of Syria and whatnot. And so they had to defend that. And the constant problem that the Christians living in the Latin East had was a shortage of manpower. And so what developed kind of organically within the church are these religious orders where you had men, warriors, who took the religious, the evangelical councils, rather, of poverty, chastity, obedience. But then they also took special vows to protect pilgrims in the Holy Land in those areas that were not under Christian control and to defend the Christian territory that had been liberated. So they manned these castles and fortresses and the frontier posts all throughout the Latin East. What happens with the Templars is that the Templars become very, very popular. As I mentioned, St. Bernard helps their popularity spread by his preaching. Their numbers grow. They accumulate land and wealth as wealthy noblemen die and give them benefices and things like this. And so they also establish they become very well organized, and they establish kind of a modern banking system almost in terms of, I consider it like the creation of the first ATM machines. Hmm. And what I mean by that was that if you were a Christian pilgrim living in England or France or any other part of Christendom and you wanted to go to the Holy Land, or parts in the East, you didn't want to carry large sums of cash with you or any kind of material wealth of that manner. So you would take your cash. You could go to a Templar manor house in London, for example, and you could deposit your coinage, and you would get a deposit slip from the Templar house saying Lord so and so deposited X number of monetary value here. They would give you the slip, and then you would take that slip with you when you got to the Holy Land and you got to the Templar house in Jerusalem, for example, when it was under Christian control. You could walk in there and give them your slip, and they would give you your money minus a surcharge, right? So even in the beginning, there were ATM fees. and they give you your money. And so they, but by doing that and collecting the surcharge, obviously became extremely wealthy. And so to answer your question, over time, when you get to the 14th century, the King of France is very jealous and envious of their influence, first of all, especially in his own territory, and very much concerned with their wealth. And so he brings up false charges against them to get the Pope to suppress the order in order to limit their influence and authority in his realm so that he would have greater influence and authority. So their downfall was pretty much a political situation caused by the King of France. And then they were suppressed in the early part of the 14th century.
Okay. Wow, what a career for that order, the story. Well, Steve, in the closing minutes of the show, we've been talking about the glory of the Crusades here and your new book on that published by Catholic Answers Press. I guess I'd just like to close out these last couple minutes by asking you quickly about Lepanto. My students in the Catholic Studies program at Aquinas love Chesterton's poem Lepanto. I think it was about a year and a half ago or so, we had a pretty great event where we would read the poem and I would talk about the battle. Our students in our Rome semester on the Feast of the Holy Rosary, formerly Our Lady of Victory, would march around Rome after reading this poem and chanting it and that sort of thing. And it seems to have that the poem seems to have legs. What is it about Lepanto that, I mean, there just seems to be a revival in the interest in this poem, which I think means there's a revival in interest in the true story of what you cover as a crusade, and that is the turning back of the Turks at Lepanto by the Christian fleet.
Yeah, I think Lepanto is fantastic. I mean, the poem by Chesterton itself is great, and I'm glad to hear you have your students read that. And we have a Wydenkopf family tradition that every year on the Feast of Our Lady of the Holy Rosary, and we gather around the dining room table, and after dinner I read the poem to the children. So
that's great.
Know the poem and know the story and everything. I think why the resurgence, I guess, of it, or the focus on Lepanto is it was a significant event, obviously. It's the end of the 16th century. You have this large, Ottoman Turkish invasion fleet that's being assembled to invade and conquer Rome, and put an end to, the Christian faith and Christendom as a whole. And you have this outgunned and outnumbered, smaller Christian fleet led by Don Juan of Austria, who, achieves this miraculous victory. And there's all kinds of fantastic little, vignettes and stories of the battle. And you have people like, Miguel Cervantes, the author of Don Quixote, who participates in the battle, and called it later on the greatest day's, work, in his life. And you have, various amounts of obviously heroism on the Christian side. You have these 14,000 Christian galley slaves that the Turks had, rowing their ships, who are freed as a result of the battle. It was a momentous event. I mean, obviously, so much so that the Pope, St. Pius V, as you mentioned, creates the commemoration of this event on the liturgical calendar, initially under the title of Our Lady of Victory, because of Mary's intercession in the battle and the great victory that was won there. So I just think that that's a part of a resurgence of Catholic identity. It's a great story. It's a David versus Goliath, in a certain sense, kind of story that Catholics can gravitate to. And hold on to as a victory over Islam. That was extremely important as well. So I talk about, as you mentioned in the book, it is considered a part of the crusading movement, and crusading indulgence was granted to those who participated in the Battle of Lepanto and in the Holy League fleet led by Don Juan. So it's a really interesting moment in the entire history of Christendom.
Well, that's going to be the last word on today's Faith and Reason. This is Dr. John Panero, your host. Been talking with Steve Wydenkopf about his new book, The Glory of the Crusades. It's an excellent book. I think you should take it out. Go check it out. Steve, thank you very much for being on our program today.
John, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time and the interview. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And thank you for tuning in to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Panero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Panero is Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.